Welcome to the Wild Mother Podcast, where we're reclaiming the innate wisdom of our bodies, our babies, and the earth. I'm your host, Dr. Jessica Hodges, researcher, mama, and creator of the Wild Mother Pregnancy Journey. Join me for evidence-based and soul-centered conversations about physiologic birth, natural parenting, and thriving motherhood. And let's weave a new story of what mothering and life on earth can be. Welcome to the Wild Mother Podcast. Mama, I know that you already know that life in the 21st century can sometimes feel like an assault on our nervous systems. Our lives are faster and busier, we're subjected to more information, we have more stuff, more choices, more stress and overwhelm than any previous generation. And that has very real consequences for our well-being. Now, if that's the case for us as adults, it's even more so for our developing children. So how can we protect our little ones from the overwhelm of 21st century life? How can we honor the sanctity of their childhood? Well, my guest today is none other than Kim John Payne, a child and family counselor, a consultant, educator, and researcher, and the author of a number of pretty incredible books, including the number one bestseller, Simplicity Parenting, Using the Extraordinary Power of Less to Raise Happier, Calmer, More Secure Kids. Kim says that our faster, busier society today is waging an undeclared war on childhood of too much stuff, too many choices, too much sexiness, too much information, and too much speed. And while we don't have the power to change the whole world, we do have the power as parents, Kim says, to declare peace in our homes. Today's episode is such a hopeful one, mamas, because it's about the choices that we get to make as parents to give our children a childhood in a time when that's no longer a given. So in today's episode, we talk about Kim's observations over a more than 30-year career that average kids without any obvious history of trauma are experiencing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, just as a result of the cumulative stresses of living in the 21st century world. And then we talk about the work of Simplicity Parenting that Kim developed to help families consciously wind back the different sources of stress in their children's lives, with the result that kids who'd been labelled with disorders were able to slide back along a behavioural spectrum into just being their own quirky, beautiful selves. And then we talk about how this work is not just relevant for kids who've been labelled with disorders, it's relevant for all children. So Kim talks us through the 5 layers of simplifying that he's come to develop. That's simplifying our children's environment through cutting back on the sheer amount of stuff they're surrounded by, toys, clothes, books, everything else. 2, bringing warm, nurturing rhythms and rituals into our children's day to give them a sense of order and safety. 3 is balancing our little ones' schedules so that they have time to just be. 4 is filtering out adult information from our children's awareness. So that means looking at our kids' screen use, but it also means considering the ways that we as adults speak in front of our kids. Because it's not just too much stuff that's overwhelming for children, it's also the clutter of too much information. And finally, we talk about creating values-centered family leadership instead of a child-centered family culture. So that means getting really clear on our values as parents and then creating a family culture that truly reflects our values and our desires for our lives and our families. Kim's thinking and teaching has been such a gift to me in my own experience of parenting, so I'm really honored to bring his insights to you, my beautiful community. So if you enjoy today's episode, Mama, it would mean the world to me if you left a review over on iTunes, because that's what helps get this podcast in front of other wild mamas who could also benefit from these conversations. And you can also share this podcast with other mamas just by taking a screenshot and sharing it over on Instagram. And don't forget to tag me at Dr. Jessica Hodgins. And now over to the warm and wise Kim John Payne. So Kim, welcome to the Wild Mother Podcast. It's such an honor to have you on the show. And I wanted to just start by letting you know and letting the listeners know, sort of first came across your work, your writing and what you teach has had a really profound impact on my own experience of parenting, because I actually am really grateful to have heard you talk on another podcast a couple of years before I even became a mother. And I really resonated with what you talked about through your work on simplicity parenting. And so I went into motherhood with this kind of conscious awareness of the need to really honor the sanctity of childhood and to treat childhood with this real sense of reverence and to create a lot of spaciousness and grace around this time. So it kind of not only has that, I think, been a gift to my little boy in me, like really consciously structuring my life so that I could create this real spaciousness around his childhood and this real protection around his childhood. It's also given me such a gift of getting to watch him unfurl into his true self, you know, like without all of the, if you forgive my language, a shitstorm of being a kid in the 21st century, just to allow him to unfurl into his true self. And he's such a delight to be around. He's just such a joy. And I really attest so much of that to you and your work. So I'm so grateful for you and the work that you do in the world. And I'm so honored to have you on the Wild Mother podcast and to get to have you share some of your insights with the women in my community.
Yeah, we get to meet at last, yes.
That's right.
You know, but it's really great to hear, though, honestly, because, you know, we all have these big projects in our lives from time to time. And writing books is just one of many different kinds of big projects. Which just pales into insignificance to raising a child, right? Birthing a child. I mean, honestly, people say, oh, you're birthing a book. I think, oh, no, that is just nothing compared to birthing a child. But, you know, but it's lovely to hear that it helped and it helped your little boy and your family because, well, you know, with all these projects, if it just helps just someone, it's worth it, right?
Mm-hmm. So thank you. Thank you. Kim, I wanted to get you to start by talking a little bit about your work in the world. I've alluded to it a little bit, but the work that you offer in the world to children and families, and then the journey that's led you to this work, because I think your early work with children in different parts of the world and their kind of very different lived experiences, but the commonalities in some of their experiences, right? It really says so much about childhood in the 21st century and actually life in the 21st century and how the 21st century world is really kind of an assault on our nervous systems as humans, as adults, and especially for developing children.
Yeah, it sure can be, can't it? And it takes, the thing I love about the times we live in, really, is that it offers us as parents a chance to make some really conscious decisions. Mm. In the past, we just kind of, you know, generations back, probably our grandparents or great-grandparents, not so long back, really, in terms of the big picture, they just raised kids the way they were raised, right? But the thing I love about raising kids now is that we get to make choices. Mm-hmm. And if we want to have them have a childhood, it's not a given anymore. Mm-hmm. So we get to make choices about how we do that. And that's thrilling. I think it's wonderful, mm-hmm. you know, that we get to do that.
Yeah.
And anyone listening to your podcast, it obviously is making some choices. Otherwise, you know, it's a self-selective, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, actually where this began for me was working in a group home, actually, funny enough, for teenagers. It wasn't with little kids at all. Mm. My work has got over the years with younger and younger and younger and younger kids. It's just expanded into really, really little kids and pregnancy and so on. But I was working with a group of teenagers in a group home who'd come from some pretty hard backgrounds. And they were either wards of the state, they were coming out of boys and girls detention centers, or were coming to us as a bit of a last chance before they went inside. Mm-hmm. They were repeat offenders, but many kids had got into trouble with the law through no fault of their own. You know, and I was just a young guy, you know, I was about 20 when I started working in a group home where the kids were 13 through 18. It wasn't a really smart personnel move, I'll tell you what. oh, gee. I was only a couple of years older than some of the older kids. Yeah, yeah. But I was going to university during the daytime, and I was studying psychology, child psychology, child and adolescent psychology. And I'm okay now, Jess. I always add that really quickly. You know, I'm fully recovered from the experience of psychology. And there was this guy talking who'd been a medic in the Second World War as a very young guy. And then he had qualified as a doctor, and during the Korean War and the Vietnam War, and he was still active actually in the Vietnam War, he was a visiting professor at our university. And he was talking about combat veterans who weren't doing so well. And the term PTSD wasn't known back then much. Mm. He would talk about trauma response. So that was the term he was using, but it's what we now know, it's PTSD. And what really struck me was that As he talked about, like he would talk about nervous, like really kids with nervous systems that were on high alert. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's like Mitch in my group home. It's not a combat veteran. That's Mitch. In fact, that's Darren. That's Warren. And then he'd say, well, and kids who are really combat veterans, which are really over controlling. And I thought, well, that's Maria, Lizzie. And he talk about kids who were not just hypervigilant, but would startle at noises and jumpy. Mm. That was all of them. That was every single one of them. He'd talk about combat veterans who would be very over-controlling of their close relationships, husbands, wives, so on. Well, wives in those days. Mm-hmm. And these kids were in my group home were really over-controlling with each other, and they would argue and fight. Like they just, it was over a simple little thing, but it seemed like their life depended on it. You know, they would, it was way out, an overreaction.
Yeah.
And then what really startled me was he talked about night terrors. Now, I worked the night shift from 6 o'clock in the evening to 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. It was called the action shift, mm-hmm. because it was. A lot of stuff would happen, and kids jumping out windows and all that sort of stuff, and police bringing kids back. But really what was striking was the number of night terrors. And my female colleague and I, who was a mum of a teenager herself, bless her heart, because I wouldn't be able to survive without her. Mm. We would cruise into the kids' rooms and sit together, you know, with the kids and just calm them. And then we'd move to another bedroom and just calm another night terror and another night terror. It was really disturbing how many kids would have these night terrors. So that was it for me. I approached him, you know, and just said, it was a, you know, fancy university, and you don't usually approach lecturers. They're sort of literally on a stage. Mm-hmm. I'm Australian. We don't stand for that for very long. And so I just said a quick good day and then asked him. I said, look, you're describing combat veterans who are struggling, but you're actually describing every single one of the kids in the group home that I'm caring for, you know? And yet they haven't been to war. What's happening? And he was a lovely man. And he engaged, he even visited our group home several times. The kids called him Dr. Dude. And they broke into his car one day. But anyway, and I watched it happening out the window. Oh my goodness. But he really said, you've got to look into this further. Would you journal it? Would you take notes about it? Could we stay in conversation with it? I said, of course, I'd be honored. And we started a communication that was to last many years. Mm-hmm. Because after my time was up in that group home, I, with his encouragement, traveled and volunteered in Southeast Asia, which at the time was a little bit like the Middle East and is now. I mean, there was a lot of dislocation, a lot of war, a lot of homeless people, politically on fire, really. And so I worked in Jakarta and then up through and ended up in the Thai Cambodian refugee camps right at the end of the Vietnam War. Mm. In the mop up. Well, actually, it wasn't at the end because Cambodia was still, the Khmer Rouge was still active and so on. So, and there again, I saw nervous, jumpy, hypervigilant kids who are not able to go back to a restful state. That nervousness that you mentioned, Jess, the nervous systems were on high alert. Mm-hmm. And the night terrors. The night terrors in this camp, because there were, you know, thousands of people, the night terrors in this camp were blood-curdling, the screams and so on from the kids. So again, you know, I was just a young guy, but got together with a bunch of other young volunteers, and we would cruise the camp just soothing kids down. I knew a little bit about soothing kids by now, mm-hmm. and we would just soothe them down, calm them on down. And so, but there they were again, nervous, jumpy, hypervigilant, over-controlling, rejecting anything new, unable to make transitions. They couldn't move from one thing to another. Very mistrustful of anyone new coming into their environment, and kind of like on fire, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I could get my head around it because these kids were escaping war. So, okay, the fact that they were looking like combat veterans, yeah, that makes sense, yeah. Right? Because they weren't, but they'd been escaping it. All right. So when my term was up there, I decided to study this some more, do post-grad study. So I traveled further to London in the UK and started studying this. And I set up a little counseling practice. And this is really the main point, not so much the study, but the little counseling practice. And I thought this was going to be, by this stage, I just wanted just a little calm, quiet. I had James Herriot in mind, mm-hmm. you know, just a little sweet little counseling practice in England. But through the door came nervous, jumpy, hypervigilant, over-controlling kids with night terror. There they were. And it wasn't as elevated as the kids in Cambodia and Thailand, but it was pretty noticeable.
Yeah.
Only these were kids from mixed economic backgrounds, racial, ethnic backgrounds. These were just kids. Yeah. These were just much more regular kids. And for a while, I tried to not notice it because it was too big a thought. Mm. I thought, you know, when something is too big and you mm-hmm. just don't want to let it in. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I had to start looking at it. And these kids looked like wartime kids. Now, this is back in the 80s, Jess. You know, like,
yeah.
It was nothing like the pressure on kids these days.
Yeah.
But the thought occurred to me when I looked at their lives. And I looked at the whole of their lives, and I started training to be a Waldorf kindergarten teacher, like a Steiner kindergarten teacher, because I was fascinated by the approach of these kindergarten people. I never thought I'd be like doing it, but I thought, I've got to learn about this. I'm one of these people who do courses all the time.
Yeah, and, I'm a bit like that myself.
Right.
And I share your fascination with the Steiner approach, and I can see its influence in your work, which is just another thing that I love about your approach.
Yeah, you know, and there are a number of influences, but absolutely that is one. And so I started, like Steiner, kindergarten teachers do home visits. Mm-hmm. And so I started doing home visits. And they do that beautifully, and they do it a lot, and they do it well. And there was nothing in these kids' lives that indicated combat veterans, war, that like kids in group homes. So what was it? What was it? What was it? You know? Mm. And then the thought occurred to me that this was cumulative stress. Mm. It was because life had sped up so much that their nervous systems and the whole neurological system wasn't coping. And it was at the time where brain imaging equipment was starting to find out that it wasn't just the classic memory centers in the brain that we all knew about, that the amygdala, the reptilian trauma, fight or flight brain, had a memory. And it was back in the time of microfiche. That dates me, right? Microfiche. And I was reading in these big libraries, big old domed ceilings, and I'd be reading and reading and reading these studies and looking at the pictures and so on. Because as just a little undergrad guy, I didn't have access to that equipment, but I could read the studies. And I thought, you know what? I had a really simple thought, because I didn't have enough advanced degrees yet to not have a simple thought. and I had a simple thought. It's cumulative. It's cumulative. It's building up and it's storing up in that stress memory. And that stress, and what's happening is that the overwhelm the kids were experiencing was building just through the unrelenting too much, too soon, too sexy, too young. It was overwhelm. And I was looking not at wartime kids. I was looking at kids who were in the undeclared war on childhood. That's who I was looking at. And no one had thought to declare it because it had just crept up slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was now the new normal.
That's right. It's that distinction between what's common and what's normal in terms of like our physiologic norms and what we need as humans to thrive. So yeah, the new normal, but not normal for children in the context of our entire evolution, really, right?
Yeah, well, totally. It's interesting you mention evolution because years later, I actually asked a friend of mine who's an evolutionary neurologist.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that for a job, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, you know, the brain is plastic, right? It would adapt. It really would, wouldn't it? You know, to the pace of modern life. And she said, probably. But for the first time in human evolution, the amygdala, the palabrenna mentioned before, the reptilian, very ancient brain, for the first time in human evolution, it's actually enlarging.
Mm.
It's actually growing, not becoming less active. It's more active and actually growing, like physiologically growing. But she said, look, I'll run the data. I'll get back to you. She's a real academic type, you know. Thanks. And she got back to me a couple of weeks later and said, well, I've got good news and bad news. And she said, what do you want? First, I said, of course, the good news. And she said, well, the good news is the brain might adapt. It might well. I said, okay, thank you. And she said, don't you want to know the bad news? I said, no.
Let's leave it at that.
absolutely not. And she said, I'll give you a figure. And she said, 900 years. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, it's on a curve. And if we flattened out the curve today, the stress curve, if we flattened it today and it did not rise one little bit, then a child's brain would be good to go and cope with the pace of life in 900 years.
Mm.
In other words, we've got 900 years ahead of our kids' ability to absorb all this stuff.
Yeah.
Now, going back to what I was talking about before, to finish that little story, this is a long story, sorry, but it's your fault because it was a really good question.
I'm really enjoying the story. I think it says so much as well.
Well, see, the end of the story is that I thought, well, if stress could be cumulative, what about if we explored it and cumulatively took it away, like unstressed, wherever we could in the little practice I had? So I started involving that in my postgrad studies as well and writing it up and doing case studies and action-based research and all that fancy stuff. But we're basically sitting with mums, mainly mums, sometimes dads, and we would make a plan to unstress a child's life in whatever way we could. And the amazing thing was how these kids whose behaviors were really problematic or disordered or diagnosed and pathologized, and I'm not a big fan of pathologizing kids, but they started just becoming their quirky little self. Okay, so after all said and done, here's what I came up with. Every kid has their quirks. They're born, they come out of the birth canal. But the birth of my first daughter, I was waiting to hear the golden harps and lights and angels and candles. And she came out of the birth canal, I swear, looking me in the eye, rolling up her metaphoric sleeve, saying, can you cope with me? And the look in her eye when she was born was, please help me. I can only think of those two words. It's still moving to this day, you know, when I think of it, please help me. And all our kids come with their quirks. They can be feisty little ones. They can be very orderly. They can be very active. Some mums, I was talking to a mum, I have a private, you know, I have a family counseling practice, you know, speaking with a bunch of mums and dads just this morning. And one mum said to me this morning, you know, I felt this little guy right from the get-go moving about in the womb and he was going to be a goer. And it's proven absolutely right.
Mums know.
you know, right? You can feel it. And he's a movement boy. Mm-hmm. He defines himself through movement. You know, I think it was Descartes, that philosopher said, I think, therefore I am, right? Famous quote. For this little guy, it was, I move, therefore I am, right? It was how he defined himself.
Yeah.
Only the teachers at school were trying to stop him move, trying to stop him moving around. There's, you know, schools for boys are just hostile places, any for most schools. These kids who were like ADHD, right, which is such a silly name. It's not attention deficit. It's attention excess, for goodness sake. Who thought up that name? Anyway, but these kids who were so-called hyperactive, when we calmed their lives down, they were movement boys and girls, movement kids. The kids who had OCD, obsessive compulsive disorders, when we calmed their lives down and calmed the amygdala down and calmed the trauma response down, they were just organized little chaps, you know, organized little children. The children who had ODD, you know, opposition defiance disorder, they were just the feisty ones. Yeah. When we unstressed their lives and whatever we could do, I'm not denying this, these things are all possible, but it's an inflamed quirk. It's a soul fever. I came to think of it as soul fever, emotional fever, because it's like our immune systems in our body, when they're overwhelmed, we get a flu, right? But our emotional system, when that's overwhelmed, we also get a flu. We get an emotional flu. We get an emotional fever. We shiver it with cold and pull back from the world and get stubborn and sullen and depressed, or we sweat it out and get angry and aggressive and hyperactive. It's just a cold or hot fever. But these kids had emotional soul fevers.
Yeah.
And when we simplified, we brought them back magically, like I didn't know it was going to happen, right? I hoped. Into just being their quirky, you know, like, you know, their quirks is what makes them so lovable and so infuriating, right? At times too, but it's just their quirks.
Yeah.
And a calmed quirk is just there they are. And so many mums said to me, I feel like I've got my little kid back.
Yeah.
I've got him back.
Yeah. And I love this research that you've done so much, because I think, yeah, this is the issue when we, you know, all these D's that you're talking about, ADD, and it's the D, it's the disorder, right, that we're focusing on. It's pathologizing behavior instead, and then medicating that pathology instead of looking at the cause. What's pushing these kids with their quirks, as you, like this is using your language, with their quirks, pushing them into disorder, like pushing them along a spectrum. What's the thing that's doing that? It's cumulative stress. So if you're reducing the stress, you're really treating the cause of the issue and allowing those kids to come back into themselves. And it's just, it makes me reflect on, you know, my brother was autistic and then was diagnosed with ADHD at about the age of 12, and he was put on Ritalin, and he didn't want to be on Ritalin, and he was such a clever kid and such an empathetic kid, like intensely empathetic kid. And I just think of, you know, if he, you were talking about consciousness before, right, and that we can make choices, and I think if he and my mum at that time had this information, because he was out there, you know, researching all of these world issues, like because of this intense empathy that he had, he was so overwhelmed by all of this information and the weight, literally carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders, right? Imagine if he and mum had known that and had understood the impact that that stress was having on his nervous system, and could then have made choices like, okay, medication's an option, but here's some other options that maybe we can try to just, yeah, take that stress off and to allow him to simmer down back into himself with all his quirks and his beautiful empathy and his intensity and all of those things, but within a just a normal for him healthy range.
It's well, you know, kids who are autistic, particularly kids who I think of them as neural diverse, you know, they're just, we have diversity in the world, why not neural diversity?
Yeah,
right. He is perfectly beautiful the way he is. That's his diversity, right? And one of the things that I've noticed, well, you see, we have over 1,200 simplicity parenting coaches and group leaders around the world.
Wow.
So that we get a lot of feedback from many different cultures, right? And it's a simple little training. Well, it'd be ironic if it was complicated, right? But there's this little quiet army of mums and dads out there all over the world, probably as we're speaking, meeting in church halls, in their lounge rooms, and you know, wherever they can, probably these days in parks, you know, and supporting people to simplify and dial back and giving them permission and confidence to do it. So the feedback we get is just about every, well, there's just about every continent apart from the North and South, Antarctica and Arctic. Everywhere we have these coaches and group leaders. And one of the things that we hear over and over with neurodiverse kids is that they particularly benefit from this simplifying and balancing approach because their hearts are so open to the world. It's almost like their spiritual or emotional clothing is open weave. Do you know what I mean? And a lot comes in. They take and they notice everything. Yeah. So if a child is a highly sensitive child, regardless of whether they're neurodiverse or, you know, autistic or not, if you have a highly sensitive child, then it's important for that weave to not be, it's important to honor the weave that is and then dial back what the child is being asked to absorb. You can either say, that's wrong, you have to be different to an autistic kid, or you can say, that is perfectly right, and what we need to do is dial back what you're being asked to absorb because you're absorbing two or three times more than I even understand. So we've got to dial that back. And then you see these children, they kind of, you mentioned unfurling before. You use the word unfurling, lovely word. Then their emotions can unfurl, and so they don't have to be so explosive, so defended, so sort of pushing away. And if the world quits being hostile, then they open, and this can be the most beautiful, well-adjusted kids. Now, this quirk thing I'm talking about, you see, what happened and what happens to this day, and it happens, you know, it happens every day because of this quiet little, well, dare I say, army of people basically, you know, in this undeclared war on childhood, helping parents declare peace in their homes. Because that's the only place we can control. We can't control all the stuff that's going on in the world, but we can declare peace in our homes. We can do that. What happens is that if you keep simplifying and keep balancing, and it's no big deal, it's just giving kids a childhood. It's not counterculture, strictly speaking. It's just trusting your instinct, trusting your gut, because many of us know, hang on, this is just not right. Few of us had to cope with what these kids are having to cope with today. If we keep balancing and just simplifying, making very basic judgments about what we do, what we don't do, how many play dates we have, do I take my little baby to the supermarket or do I not? Or if I absolutely have to, do I put a little muslin cloth over it so that what she sees is filtered? Do I snuggle her up and put a big, lovely, warm crib cap on her so that what she hears or he or they hear is slightly muffled when the announcement comes over from the supermarket that someone is needed in the meat department?
It's so subtle.
Doesn't need to know about the meat department and hear that big booming noise or see all that stuff. So there are decisions we make on a day-to-day basis. But here's the thing, Jess, and this is what we found back in the more academically oriented studies, but also in all the, it's really now hundreds of thousands of people that this approach has touched, is that it's not just the child who is ADD, ODD, PDD, you know, like there's no shortage of Ds, lots available.
Yeah.
They don't just return back to their quirk. Actually, their calmed quirk is their genius. That's their gift. So the kid who is ADD, like always moving around, his quirk is just a movement boy, movement kid, right? Movement girl. But their gift, their genius is movers and shakers. Only now they're saying the right thing at the right time, at the right volume to the right person. Whereas before they were saying the wrong thing to the wrong person, absolutely at the wrong volume. Do you know what I mean? Because they were in fight or flight, freeze or flock. When you calm the soul fever down, now their timing is on. Now they're not worried about, am I going to be eaten, which is what the amygdala is. No, I am safe. I am secure. The kid who had OCD, looping round and round, their quirk is just that they like to see, they like their organized little kids. And now their organization is as quirky as can be. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't think it looking at it, but they know. But when you continue to calm their lives down and just give them a basic childhood, they notice. There's a little kid I was working with a couple of weeks ago whose mum was saying, now that he's calmed down, he didn't have a formal diagnosis of OCD, but he was looping. Mm-hmm. And he was on the road for that problematic behavior, and he was incredibly protective of his toys. Mm-hmm. And the mother was trying to get him to share. And I'm not a big fan of forcing kids to share. Mm-hmm. That's very high order. They can take turns, mm-hmm. right? But anyway, she'd worked and worked and worked to calm his life down. And what he was doing now was that he socially, with his two siblings, was the center of organizing play, because these are organizers, right? Mm-hmm. Freed to be in the frontal lobes of the brain, freed to be in their best little social emotional selves. The kid who is OCD, what's their gift? Superb, well-timed social organizers, and so on. Still moves me to this day when I hear a parent say, oh, you would not guess what's happening. And I can't, because so kids are so individual. So I say, no, tell me. And they'll tell me, and their genius is starting to emerge.
Yeah.
It's thrilling.
Yeah. Hey, Mama. If you're listening to this episode, I'm going to make a bold assumption that you're somewhere in your motherhood journey, that you care about natural health for yourself and your baby, and that you're interested in making choices based on evidence and what feels right for you, rather than on misinformation and dogma. So if that's you, I'd like to invite you to grab your copy of my free guide, The 4 Things You Actually Need to Know to Prepare for a Physiologic or Natural Birth. In this guide, I walk you through everything that you actually need to know about how to prepare for an undisturbed birth without the misinformation overload that you'll get from searching all over the internet. This guide has now become an essential part of the birth preparation for hundreds of women, and you can grab your copy at the link in the show notes or by searching jessicahodgins.com/guide-to-birth. That's jessicahodgins.com/guide-to-birth. Okay, back to the episode, mamas. It's beautiful. And this is really, you know, I really think our role as parents, our kids come into this world with gifts to share with the world. And I really feel strongly that my role as a parent is as a guardian of my children's childhood, a real buffer, you know, like you used the analogy of the harbor. And I kind of like to think of it as like a tree, like a strong tree with deep roots. And that's my role, to hold my branches out over my little boy so that he has a safe place to grow into his true self, so that then he can move out into the world with his gifts fully developed, so that he can be a strong tree as well. But he needs that, you know, like if you plant a little sapling in an open plain, it's going to get whipped around by the wind and the storm. It's not going to be able to grow up into that strong tree with deep roots. So this is how I kind of like to think of my role as a parent, to hold everything back out of his way so that he can grow into his true self with all his gifts and his quirks, and then go and offer those as gifts to the world. And it's such a, you know, I think our work is especially challenging today in the 21st century. You know, like, as you said, even in the 80s, you were seeing this undeclared war on childhood. But my goodness, what is it now in the 21st century?
It's really interesting, because a friend of mine who wrote a book called Never Broken, and she's a singer who has a way of really encapsulating, and she wrote that this beautiful song. And in her Never Broken book, she talks about it again. And she talks about hardwood grows slow. Mm-hmm. Her name is Jewel, the singer Jewel.
Yeah.
And she grew up in Alaska, and she had a very, very hard childhood, and she would escape to the woods. Mm-hmm. And she noticed through all her time in the woods that when the storms blew through up in Alaska, that it was the fast growing trees, and the trees that weren't protected would blow over. Mm. But the trees that grew slow, those were the ones that survived the storm.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that had the deeper roots. and hardwood, and that metaphor that Jewel talks about really struck me deeply, because I thought, see, what we're trying to do in modern childhood is we're trying to pack 18 years of development into 8 years.
Yeah.
We're trying to grow our kids up real quick. Parenting has almost become like a contact sport, mm-hmm. or like an arms race, you know, where we've got to get our kids lots of stuff. It's almost a philosophical choice we face when we first have our children. Like, do we see parenting and childhood as an enrichment opportunity where we've got to get as much stuff in as we can, as quickly as we can? Mm. Or do we see it as a gently unfolding experience?
Mm.
Which way? Which way are we going to go?
Mm.
Which way are we going to go?
Mm.
And this hardwood grows slow. You see, when our kids grow up and they're now, they're just these tiny little things, but one day, and I know it's a cliche, but in an eye blink, they're 20.
Yeah.
20 years old, and they're stepping out into the world, right? I mentioned to you before we started recording today, my daughter, she's 20, and she leaves to get on a plane to Australia today. Oh, I live in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And off she goes, right?
Yeah.
Off she goes. And what you hope you've done is you've given them this hardwood experience, this deep-rooted oak tree experience, so that when the wind blows, when the storms come, and when the inevitable really hard stuff happens in their life, maybe after we're gone, you know, maybe after we're gone, that they will have those deep roots which will help them get through it, and they won't be blown over, and they won't, really suffer, that they'll have the resiliency to be able to weather it.
Yeah.
And that's my hope. You know, if when we're on the verge of having our little children and we think ahead to, like, it's almost impossible to think like how, like 20, 18, 19, 20 years old. But I think deep in that core of our being for every young mum and dad is that wish to give our kids values, and not the pop, toxic pop culture values of you've got to dress this way, you've got to have this app, you've got to do that, you've got to present yourself in this way, you've got to. But it's the values that we want to give our kids, our family values.
Mm.
And as they grow, they develop their own. They're not going to be ours, you know. They're not going to be directly, we don't want them to just be like little replicas of us. Like, every decision we make according to our values and kind of gut instinct, mm-hmm. as opposed to what we're supposed to do. Because if we go with what is out there, like you look around your neighborhood and you go with soccer on Monday, and the kid's 3 years old, right? Mm-hmm. Soccer on Monday, ballet on Tuesday, piano on Friday, and then psychotherapy for the family on Saturday to cope with it. If we do that stuff, if we overwhelm our kids, then that's softwood right there. That's a tree that'll grow and blow over. And we're kind of coming full circle back to this conscious decision of, you know what, I'm not going with that. And the interesting thing is I know it's hard at the moment and all that sort of stuff, but I'm filled with hope for our children, actually. Mm. I'm so delighted that children are being born into this world right now,
mm-hmm.
and that they've been really smart to choose the parents they have.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we can do for them will give them the tools they need basically to fix the screw-ups that we've made.
Yeah.
And if we can make those conscious decisions, to mix my metaphors a little bit, you know, you mentioned harbor before, Jess,
mm-hmm.
not this harbor metaphor. I was on holidays once and I was looking at a harbor, actually. I was standing up on top of a high hill and I looked down over this fishing village and it had a big harbor wall, one of those man-made, person-made harbour walls. And it had a little opening and the boats would come in and come out and come in and come out. But the water that day was pretty choppy outside the harbour.
Mm.
But inside the harbour, the water was beautiful and calm. And in these boats would come and they'd be greeted by the harbour master and they'd come in and they'd repair their lobster pots and they'd repair and relax and just basically recoup.
Mm-hmm.
in this safe harbor, and all the supplies were there that they needed, and there they were. And then out they would go again. And I thought, gosh, that is so like family life, right? We're not saying we want to keep our kids in a bubble. Mm-hmm. We're saying we want a safe harbor. That's all. Yeah. And when they're little, when they're very little, their little boats will just go, will probably just pootle around the harbor, really.
Yeah.
But when they're a little bit older, they'll go to the edge of the harbor, and the harbor master, the parent, might say, off you go. And that's their first day in kindy, or whatever it is, the little play dates we have, and off you go. And out they go in the park, and they look at other children. They run back to be you and climb up you like a squirrel.
Yeah.
Right? And then out they go a little bit further until they come back, and out and back and out and back, and you until, you know, okay, now they stand about like, you know, a meter away from a, or closer, like really close, face to face, and then game on, you know, with the little one they're playing with. But that dance of attachment, it's basically the attachment dance. That's what we, and these little ones will poodle out and go outside the harbor wall one day, and they will, but they'll come back in. They won't go far. Then they're 9 or 10 or 11, and they'll go quite far. And then, but they'll come back and restore and tell you their sad stories about not being included because everyone in the class and has an iPhone, and I'm 10 years old now, and why shouldn't I? And, you know, we're depriving them of neural damage. And the, I can't help but slip that in. And the, that's another conversation.
Right? Yeah.
And then they're 16 and they'll go far, but then they'll come back because they're hurt, they're wounded, that something happened, or they're elated that something really great happened, but back they come. And then will come the day where they go out, and they go out far, far, like on an aeroplane tonight to Sydney, and they'll go far, but they'll come back. And it's what we're looking at is not holding kids in this environment, because sometimes with extended family, they'll say to people who are trying to give children a childhood, yeah, that's not how the world works now. You know, like, really, you mean you don't have them in all these classes, and you don't? And it's like, honestly, I think we should look at our mums who say that sort of stuff, mums and dads, if you're just having a child, and to say, mum, look, you raised me to be a woman of values. You did. Thank you. Thank you for raising me to be a woman of values. Giving my children a childhood is my value. I know you don't agree with it, but it is my value. It's your fault. but it's the safe harbor and allowing them to go out, but having a place for them to come back to. That's our aim. Now, we don't always do the greatest job of that, and our environment might mean it's really, really hard to do. But we're aiming. I don't know a parent alive who doesn't aim to do that. Yeah. We all aim to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what your work does so beautifully is to really illustrate the importance of it. So then our parents can have confidence in making choices that are actually often pretty different to the cultural norm, to really feel strong in that, because this is why. Like, this is what we're setting our children up for. I'd love to talk to you a little bit in the time that we have left about, because you really have a kind of like a roadmap, really, of for how parents can do that, can create a safe harbor for our children, to create, you know, the family home as a safe place for our children to be children, and to get rid of some of that cumulative stress that comes with living in the world today. And I'd love to get you to kind of talk through some of the approaches that you talk about. And I'm going to refer anybody listening, if this is resonating with you, to go and read Kim's book, Simplicity Parenting, because this is where he really talks you through all of these layers of stress that we can start to unwind. And this is not just relevant for kids with a D, where you've been diagnosed with a disorder, right? This is relevant for all children. Yeah. So I'd love to talk with you a little bit, because you have kind of five layers that you talk about, Kim, in Simplicity Parenting that we can look at as parents.
Yeah. And those layers, by the way, I absolutely did not invent these. You know, having accompanied countless parents through their journey of balancing, yeah, and giving their children the childhood, myself and this team, this huge team of group leaders and coaches that we have around the world, we've just noticed. And we've noticed essentially five things that are very common to most homes. Mm-hmm. And they're things, they're five pathways to simplify that feel pretty doable and will kind of be around in 5, 6, 10 years. So they don't feel like you're living in some clever authored parenting book thing. Yeah. They feel like they're you. It's not someone else doing this. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things we noticed is, and I sort of put these in order, but it doesn't have to be in any order at all, is you used the word before, Jess, of spaciousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is opening up a bit of spaciousness at home, like decluttering, mm-hmm. like really having just 5 or 10 toys mm-hmm. and then having the others go away in a box and being a toy library. Mm-hmm. So one goes away. And one comes out, and it's like a dear old friend arriving back.
Yeah.
Yeah. But just what is rare is precious, right? So I know books, we want to have, hundreds of books around the home, but they end up being construction material. Books are precious. So why not have 3 or 4 books out and the rest away, just away?
Yeah.
And they cycle in and they cycle out. Same with clothing. Why have all 4 seasons of clothing out? Or if you're up north, 2 seasons, or here in the northern hemisphere down south. But just really simplify and strip out the amount of clothing you've got, put some away, and seasonalize the clothing. Yeah? So, but the thing that we've discovered over the years is that when you're decluttering a home, it's really important to declutter our spaces first, our own spaces, before we touch a child's space. Don't even go near it. Mm-hmm. We declutter our own space. And then secondly, after that, we declutter common spaces, kitchens, lounge rooms. And it feels lovely. It feels
so nice, doesn't it? Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And children love it and there's space to move. So that when we come to declutter their space, they're so... like, Mummy, can we have that? Can we do that? So it's, so decluttering is one of those layers. Mm-hmm. And it feels so good. And there's a lot of people who have done that who just feel that that's their first small, doable step. All our coaches and group leaders have this word they use or phrase, small, doable steps, right?
Yeah.
So it feels like it's you doing it, right? Mm-hmm. Because Simplicity Parenting is a weird book. Someone said to me when it first came out, a lot of people have said it since, but Kim, this is the strangest parenting book because it doesn't tell you to do one single thing.
Yeah.
It just tells you to do less. Right? You don't feel like you've got to do a whole bunch of stuff because that would be ironic as well. So the second layer that we noticed that really helps kids' nervous systems calm on down and stay calmed and then get excited, like, that's good. But then calm down again, is having rhythm and rituals. Mm-hmm. Rhythm and rituals. Rhythm is the big when, like we get up at these, roughly speaking, at this time. We have breakfast at this time. We then have our morning tea or snack at this time, lunch at this time. We have our dinner at this. And it's rhythm is the big when. Mm-hmm. Rituals are the little how. So when a little one, very little, comes into the bathroom at night for their bath, and they toddle on in with their pajamas, and they put their pajamas on the dinosaur hook, because there's a little picture, because I like dinosaurs. And then they hop over to the bath, and they get into the bath, and there's their face washer. There it is. Mm-hmm. It's the blue one. I like the blue one. And I only have 2 toys because my mama read this stupid Simplicity Parenting book. But right, and then I and my daddy sings me a song about, and then I get out the bath and I get rub like a burrito with chili sauce. In my big fluffy towel, that's my towel, and that goes on that towel rail, and then I go and stand on my stool, and that's my toothbrush because it's the sparkly one, and so on and so on and so on. It's like little breadcrumbs of rituals all the way to bed. Mm-hmm. Now, when you get a child to bed like that and you've established those, this is just one example, but you get a child to bed who has had that happen every single night. Every night they've had this little thing. What happens for them is 2 things really come to mind. One is that they have pictured what comes next. Mm-hmm. Next, I when I get out, my daddy's going to rub me down and go rub, rub, rub and put chili sauce on me. Nom, 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 and taste it. Right now, okay, so he knows and he's getting kind of like, is he going to do this? And he gets out and he does. Now, every time the little child pictures something that might happen next and it does, mm-hmm. that's a child being soothed. Mm. That's a soothing, that soothes a child. It calms a child. They might giggle and laugh, but it's the kind of giggle and laugh that you know they're in themselves. It's not this crazy. It's just, and the second thing is that that's a child who, when they get to bed, is ready to sleep in a better way and doesn't scream and cry and insist you sleep beside them. It's almost like a hostage-taking situation. That's a child that can be, because then it goes on, you know, that when we are in bed, we light our candle, we have our story and we say, you know, we have our little verse or prayer or poem, and then mummy goes around the room just tidying up. I'm a big fan of just moving very slowly around a child's room, not sitting with them, just slow, slow, slow movements, tidying up, putting things in place. When mummy's here, then mummy goes out the room briefly and comes back in, tidies, tidies, just moves around. You're setting a child up to be able to fall back into their angel's wings. Mm. Right, but it's all the little ritualistic breadcrumbs, the same is true at dinner time, that helps a child not be a fussy eater, because mm-hmm. all the little things we do are the same. And I don't, Jess, I don't mean rigid, mm-hmm. rigid routine. I mean warm, predictable ritual. Some people say, I don't want to do that because that's, I grew up in a home that was full of all, no, I don't, I reject that. I want, you know, I want that. But one of the things that Dan Siegel talks about in his Whole Brain Child book, mm-hmm. brilliant book, mm-hmm. he and Tina Payne, is that you, on one hand, you've got chaos, and on the other hand, you've got rigidity, chaos and rigidity, right? And what you're looking for is the middle ground of what I call resiliency.
Yeah.
So this rhythm I'm talking about, it can move into rigidity.
Yeah.
Or if you don't have it, it moves into chaos.
Yeah.
If you don't have it at all, like one parent once said to me, we're artists. We live in a creative home. And I visited that home. That was, the kids were feral, honestly. Yeah. It was like, whoa, beautiful kids, but oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So what I'm talking about is neither rigid nor chaotic. It's in that middle ground of beautiful, warm, connecting, resilient rituals and rhythm. That's the second. Mm-hmm. The third of these pathways is that of scheduling, of that of being very careful to give kids the gift of boredom. Allow them to be bored. Allow them to discover their own creativity. Do not, in my opinion, put an iPad in their hand to relieve their boredom, because out of boredom comes creativity. Mm-hmm. Not the creativity that someone else invented on a screen, but that's their creativity. Mm-hmm. We want our kids to have their own creativity and not overschedule them, like I was talking about before, to not have them rushing here and there and here and there. They need time to decompress. Mm-hmm. They need time to just be at home, just to be, to budge about, to just walk up to you and bump on you a little bit, and not just be in this whirlwind of overscheduling.
Yeah. Because that starts from, you know, babyhood. I remember my little boy was a few months old and I had this music teacher telling me that I needed to get him into music, because if they don't start learning music from a very early age, you miss an opportunity. You know, I've got other parents who are taking their kids to baby sensory classes and swimming lessons and play groups and like literally something on every day. I tried that for a few months and I was so overwhelmed. And I think, oh my goodness, what is this doing to him? Like this little baby. No, it starts so young and then it just builds and builds and builds.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I agree with the music teacher. That child, they totally do need music around them, and that's mama singing them to them. That's mama humming as she cleans up the room at night with a little candle and humming a little lullaby. they
it's
do
so
need
so simple, isn't it? Yeah, and I think that's the thing we want to outsource. We want to, you know, we have to get our kids into these formalized settings to learn things, whereas there's so much, you know, so much enrichment that's available to them in the home in relationship with their parents.
The same is true for sports. You know, I wrote this book, I co-authored this book called Beyond Winning, Smart Parenting in a Toxic Youth and Child Sports Environment. Mm-hmm. Because I was a sports person, a so-called elite junior athlete. I went through all that stuff, right? Mm. And I know it from the inside.
Yeah.
And it took a long time to recover. Some parts were okay, but most of it was not okay.
Mm.
You know, when you're a swimmer in Australia, it's kind of obsessional.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't do anyone much good, like it didn't do me much good either.
Mm.
But the same is true. Like people say, kids have got to get a sports experience. And I say, absolutely they do. And they've got to get it at 3. And I say, no, they've got to get it at 18 months. They've got to get it really young. And they say, really? You think so? I say, oh, yeah, that's called piggyback riding. That's called being out and doing underdogs on the swing.
Mm-hmm.
That's called, when they're a little bit older, climbing and building, because then children develop an all-round movement ability.
Mm.
All around what's called proprioception, mm-hmm. like where I am in space. So they're not just playing tennis with this, like, or soccer with these very narrow little movement skill sets.
Like repetitive movements, kind of thing.
Which doesn't develop their vestibular system. It doesn't develop the inner ear, the sense of where I am in space.
Mm-hmm.
So we wrote this book, Beyond Winning, the 50 questions that parents most asked us about sports. And then the 50 questions we wish we were asked. It's a very simple little book. But, kids need movement experience. They need, when they're a little bit older, of course they need to learn how to throw and catch with mum. Mm-hmm. And it's like, really, with mum, with a baseball mitt on here in the US?
Yeah.
I don't know how to do that. But honestly, you play with a baseball, you put a baseball mitt on and your mum, and you're playing with a five-year-old. For most mums, it's about equal ability, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
You know, for dads, it's, if we haven't had a big sports experience as a dad, I don't care. I'll get out there and do it with my kid, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know how to play American football, but there you go. And we do it. And we do it out in the park. And then friends come over. This is when kids are a bit older.
Mm-hmm.
That's the third, the scheduling, really being aware of scheduling. The fourth pathway is that, and this is a controversial one. I thought it would be more controversial, and it's kind of not.
Mm.
But the is filtering out adult information.
Yeah,
is just being super aware of what we talk about in front of kids, because as a society, we've lost the plot.
Totally.
What we say in front of kids, what they hear on the radio. It doesn't matter if it's the ABC or whatever. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's just inappropriate that kids are hearing about war in Syria or whatever. It's just not okay. It's not okay they hear it. It's not okay they're exposed to so much screen media.
Mm-hmm.
It's way too much stuff that's coming at them.
Yeah.
And so filtering out adult information is huge. We could talk more about screen media some other time, Jess, but it's a big, big, big subject.
Yeah.
And again, I love it. We're parenting in this time
mm-hmm.
because we get to, like, the screen stuff is so dark. It's so nefarious. The advertisers are just jerking our chains.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are undermining our family values. It just is. I could tell you stories about this that just make your hair curl about how deliberate this is.
Yeah.
What we're talking about is having an open heart enough to not be caught up in the worldwide addiction of screens, but standing back and saying, I need to get some data on this. I need to read about this a little bit. Do I really want an iPotty? Because, you know, you can buy iPotties. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You don't know about iPotties?
No.
I'm so glad. You don't. Yeah. An iPotty. It's a potty with a stand for an iPad, and then it comes with free apps.
I'm laughing, but it's also devastating.
It's tragic, right? Because when a child's learning to potty, they need our warmth.
Mm-hmm.
They need us to be. They need us. Us. That's how. When something so beautiful is when they learn to do that. I know people think pottying beautiful, but it is.
Yeah.
Because they're so proud, and it's the beginning of competency.
Mm.
The child feeling competent.
Yeah.
I did that all by my big self.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my daughter said when she first pottied. By yeah. my big self, Daddy.
Oh.
But an eye. Anyway, the fifth layer is that of simplifying and clarifying family leadership.
Mm.
Because children are so secured when they know who's in charge.
Yeah.
Now, I don't mean that to be a kindly, benevolent sovereign,
mm-hmm.
not a malevolent dictator.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean that. But in this other book, I don't mean to be self-referential, but there's another book I wrote called The Soul of Discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, I talk about three types of discipline that we move from the governor when our children are little. When they hit 8 or 9, we've got to shift gear.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we're the gardeners. We're just big hearts with ears and big hearts with eyes. And our 9-year-old wants to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like a gardener, we make the decision
mm-hmm.
of when to harvest, when to plant. And then when they're teenagers, that's when we're the guide. You know, teenagers can be spectacularly disinterested in our opinions, but they're very interested in their direction, and we're the guide. So we move from gardener to guide. That's the very simple premise of that book.
Yeah.
So in clarifying family leadership, it's not that we're just putting a boundary in place and that's it. The boundary grows thoughtfully mm-hmm. as our children grow and can handle more space. It's a little circle. It's a little harbor. And then they go out further. So that's the fifth layer. When our children are secure and they know we are securing that harbor for them, that really helps that nervous system that you mentioned earlier. The whole sympathetic nervous system, parasympathetic nervous, the vagal pathways. Anyone knows about this stuff will
mm-hmm.
recognize these terms.
Yeah.
It helps that all be good, all yeah. be balanced.
Yeah. Yeah, creating that feeling of safety. And I think that final point that you're talking about with creating kind of value-centered family leadership, that also, it really encapsulates the whole thing, because all of these things that you're talking about actually require us as parents to look at our own stuff and our own just ways of doing things. So, you know, having just stuff everywhere in the house in terms of routines, like maybe if we're resistant to routines, I was, because I thought it may be an uncool mum. I thought it may be really uncool. And then I actually started implementing rhythms. I much prefer the word rhythms and rituals. And it made my life and my days so much more enjoyable. But it actually required me to look at why I was resisting that in the first place. You know, the scheduling thing and our need for achievement, and what was the other, filtering out adult conversations, even just like looking at how we use screens and how often we use screens and the way we talk about people and things in our home, like the culture that we're creating in our own home by how we behave and how we speak. All of these things require us to look at our own values, and is our life and the family home that we're creating in alignment with those values? And if it isn't, then you know, it kind of is, yeah, really a roadmap to get really clear on our values and our desires for our family, and then to bring the reality of our life into alignment with that. So it's such a beautiful roadmap to get really conscious and then make really simple, easy, you know, changes.
Yeah, and just to do it day by day. You know, like a lot of people talk about this simplicity parenting as, oh, for us, the jumping on point was to not do so many play dates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And others will say, oh, no, the jumping point for us, jump on point was the rhythm and rituals. That was beautiful when we did that. Our kids just loved it when it was done intentionally and warmly.
Mm-hmm.
And others will say, other parents will say, no, it's decluttering. It just gave me such a good feeling. And I did it all in a weekend when my partner took the kids camping, I just decluttered, and it was a fantastic experience, and so on. You know, the interesting thing is dialing back screens. I think it's hard. It's actually a lot easier than most of us think.
Yeah.
So, and the one to get a hold of leadership, the reason I put that number 5 in the book is that is just, you're kind of almost moving towards that, because it takes a lot of leadership to declutter. It just does. It takes a lot of leadership and intention to have rhythm and rituals. All these things, like it takes a lot of leadership to say, no, we're going home now because, or you're down the beach, no, we're going home. Because you just know that if you stay any longer, even though it's going really well, you're going to be picking up the pieces tonight, big time, right?
Yeah.
And that takes leadership. And so all these things that I mentioned that we've been talking about, leadership and clarity and intention is kind of in them all. So by the time we do that, we've actually become, well, we've actually become, you know, that harbor master that I was talking about, and we didn't even have to try.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it feels beautiful. Like what I find, like my experience, and it's taken me, Ned's 2.5 now, and it's probably taken me till he was about 2 to really feel like I had a family culture that felt good and a flow to our days that felt good. But now it feels so good. I don't feel overwhelmed. I find my little boy a joy to be around. Like I, you know, don't get me wrong, I have my moments of overwhelm and exhaustion and all of the rest. But I find parenting a joy, honestly. And I think that's a lot of that is because of simplifying so much, simplifying the clutter. We don't have that many toys. We spend a lot of time just hanging out. We have these beautiful little rhythms through the day. Yeah, it just feels good, you know. And it's a gift to our children, but I think it's a gift for us as well as parents, because we're also creating a home for ourselves.
Well, it's a little bit like, and I know we have to wrap up, Jess, but it's a little bit, the metaphor that often comes to me is that it's like our children are a little vessel. It's like they're a little vessel of themselves. You know, that's their cup. That's them, you know. And then the water of life is pouring into, there's like a tap, you know, and the water of life is pouring into that vessel. When just enough water is coming into their little beings, their little souls, that's a resilient child. Mm-hmm. That's a happy, resilient family. But when too much flow is coming into that cup and it's overwhelming and it fills up and then it starts spilling over the edge, that's a child whose behavior is now becoming fevered, right? Now, we've got a choice as parents, and perhaps this is, I can just sort of leave you with this image, if I may, is that our choice as parents is, do we spend our lives mopping up the behavioral spillage, or do we just put our hand on the tap and turn it down?
Mm.
That's the choice.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so simple and so clear. Kim, I appreciate your time so much. It's been an absolute joy to speak with you today. And thank you for sharing your information and insights with my little community. I'm going to share in the show notes for anybody who's listening who does want to connect with Kim and his work further to go and read his series of books, because you do. And I think you're currently working on another one, Kim, which I'm excited about, to go and find out more about the Simplicity Parenting Community. So I'm going to link to your website as well. Is there any other way that you would suggest parents can work with you or to learn from you, Kim?
I know what your question means, Jess, and thanks for it. But really the way, the place to go for people is right here, is right to their hearts, right to their instincts. That's the place to go. Really, that's the place to go.
What a beautiful gift, Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for listening to the Wild Mother Podcast. I'm living and mothering on the unceded country of Dharawal people, and I gratefully acknowledge their ongoing work and the work of Indigenous people everywhere in the service of thriving life on Earth. Stay wild, mamas.